But Maimrot are from the Amoraic period, so they're in a different color. They're red. And the purple are quotations from the verses of the Tanakh. Now, I don't know if you can read it. Can you read it? I'll read it from my computer and you can follow. On this Tosefta, in item number 2, Matkifla Rabbi Zera Bar Mamal. Rabbi Zera Bar Mamal asked the following question on this Tosefta. Mocher kotev lo sadi mechuralach bal kotev bitcha mikudeshetli. Said, what kind of nonsense is this? The person wants a woman, he writes the document that says, your daughter is engaged to me, and if I want to sell a field, who writes the document? The seller writes the document. He says, my field is now yours, right? You sell a used car. Don't you have to fill out a form to transfer the license to the new person? Now, if I want to engage my daughter to someone, shouldn't I be the one to write the my daughter is engaged to you? After all, I have ownership over the rights of engagement. I should write the document, just like a field. But why then does the Tosefta say that the man who's doing the Kiddushin on the woman, he should write the document? It's completely in contradiction to what is acceptable in Halacha in all other areas. Number 3, Amar Rabbah. Rabbah answered this question and said, Umachar me'achuzato b'mocher, ki kach b'baal. That when the Torah speaks about selling a field, it says, Umachar me'achuzato, putting the initiative on the seller. But when it's talking about Kiddushin, it says, Ki kach, putting the initiative on the Mekadesh, on the man who's doing the Kiddushin. And therefore, the star in sales and the star in Kiddushin are written differently because the verses themselves indicate that the processes are different. That's Rava's answer. Makes good sense, right? Number 4, Amar Rava, Hilchata Ninho, Ve'asmechinho, Rabbanan Akra'e, that these are halachot that were given to Moshe at Har Sinai about the way the different shtarot are to be written, and the use of the verses by Rabba is just an asmachta. It's an illusion, so you can find something to base it on in the text of the Mikra, but the real reason, it's Allah ala Moshe Mesinai. Now, that's the end of the sugya. That's the whole Amoraic sugya. Now notice that in steps 2, 3, and 4, who are the Amoraim who are mentioned? Zera Bar Mamal, who else? Rabba, who else? Rava. They are in chronological sequence. And therefore, if I would have scanned this in Vilna, I would have immediately come to the realization that this is an Amoraic sugya, and I would read the Amoraim first, just like we just did, and that already has given me all the core concepts that are in the sugya. Now look what happens when I add the Talmud, the fourth stage, on top of this. The Talmud has now gone like this. Here's the Amoraic sugya. The Talmud has come in like this and has added commentary before, during, and after every piece. Now, even though this is a color-coded system, if you were to start from this, what problems would there be? If I wouldn't have shown you the first three stages, just this, separating it out, you'd have, what's the context? What's relating to what? Because you can see now that there are sources, like the black sources in the middle and at the end, and at the beginning, that are already basing themselves on what was there in the red all the time. So you can't read it line by line. How do you read it? First all the red, and then you go back and read the black as a commentary. That's why you cannot learn Talmud line by line from the top to the bottom of a page. It's not meant to be read that way. It's meant to be read first all the Amoraim, first the Tanaim, then the Amoraim, and then the Gemara, in that order. Now, advanced scholars who have learned how to learn this way and know what they're doing, they don't have a problem with this because as they learn, their mind is automatically sorting the material, Tana, Amora, Stama, Tana, Amora, Stama, and their mind is processing it in that order as they go through. So they don't have a difficulty with it. But beginning students, it looks like cholent if you don't separate it out. Now this, without going through this sugya in depth, I'll just tell you that some of them, like the first line of stama that appears, is simply translating the idea of the question into Aramaic. Why is the stama doing that? Because the students were Aramaic speaking. And in order to understand the question, the teacher is giving them an aid by saying, here's the meaning of it in Aramaic. Now we'll read the Maimra. It's like I'm doing in English. It's the English of the Gemara. Okay? And then later on it explains the concepts in item 4, Aleph, 4, Bet, and 4, Gimel, it does a certain internal analysis, in-depth analysis of what was said by the Amora, which takes us off to a slight tangent, and then we have to come back to the red, to number 5, to see what's going on there. In any event, this text, the four-color, four-font text of the Talmud, at least gives you some assistance in knowing who's relating to what. But you can see why it's important to learn all four stages. Now, this setup of the Talmud in four colors, in four fonts, with the indentation of the stoma, we've already done this on Aleph Shas. 2,700 pages. It's all done already. It's right here in my computer. And we're now preparing it for digital and printed publication so that you can buy a disc, which will have on it the entire Talmud Bavli, divided into individual sugyot, set up like this. Then on top of that, we will add description of the sugyot. This is an Amoraic sugya from generations 4, 5, and 6, commented by the Stama with the following forms. So that you'll know the structure, you'll know what you're doing. But in the meantime, we're going to do a couple of exercises now so you can practice the relationship between them. If you want to learn more, then you can go to these two websites. The theory that we've studied can be found on www.talmud-rivadim.co.il. The site is bilingual. You can go into Hebrew or English side as you wish. And on the English side, if you go to where it says read, you'll see there's a list of about 25 one-page articles there that summarize everything that we've discussed here and significantly more. There's also four video clips that show me teaching the four different levels that we've discussed here, and an ability to communicate with us through that site. So if you're learning a sugya and you get stuck and you don't know how to get through it, you can write to us and we'll write back to you in a number of hours explaining to you how to look at the sugya. If you're interested in knowing about practice, that is the materials that we have for schools and for individuals, and you can see it at www.bonaich.co.il, or that's for Israel. For here, the English site is bonaich.com. Bonaich.com is the English, and COIL is the Hebrew site. Now, what exactly are we doing? What is the practical side of our activities? First of all, we're producing a Mishnah program for primary grades called Vishinantam, which is working now in 40 schools in Israel and 20 schools here in North America, and is spreading by year, certainly not due to my marketing skills, I can tell you that, but by word of mouth. Because it's based on oral learning of Mishnah, chanting of Mishnah, learning it by heart, and then learning the skills in the proper way. The program Dibarta Bam for Talmud for secondary grades will be ready in 1 year. It's now under development. And then after that's done, we're going to produce editions of Mishnah, Torah, Tanaim, and Talmud according to the methodology, and learning and research tools for all learners, including an adult education self-learning program for skills that takes a person from the beginning of Mishnah straight up through independence and Talmud. That is Sof Pasuk. Now, we have two choices. We have a half hour left together. We can either take a break and then come back and do a couple examples, or we can stick it out for a half hour and go right into the examples. What is your pleasure? You want to stick it out. What a crowd. Are there any questions at this point before we go to the examples? Yes. Yes. No, I didn't say elitist. Yeah.
Are you suggesting that the Middle of the Torah is not meant for the majority of people? Should it remain elitist? Or are you suggesting, or that what you're pushing about, is it a good thing that people, once they've mastered the community intellectualization process, is going to be true Talmud in the sense of we're now going to be skillful and re understanding what the whole real essence of Torah Shabbat is?
I personally believe that it's a good thing that it's become popularized. And I think that's why I'm developing methodologies to help that along.
Is there any app without variables? Is there any, as we all know, circuits are not the one paired or the one separate. Last example is Moshe. Shabbos.
Right. First of all, the Rambam did that already for halacha. As far as the sugyas, yeah, but as far as the sugyas are concerned themselves, we haven't considered that. At the present time, we're concerned about taking the text that exists and making it accessible. It would be a simple thing, because we've already been through all of Shas, we've numbered all the sugyot according to Perek. It would be a simple thing to make an index that says, for this topic, look at Masechet so-and-so, Perek so-and-so, sugya number so-and-so. And I'm sure that that'll be done at a later stage, but right now we're not up to that yet. To some extent. Yeah. To some extent it's been done, yeah. Other questions? Yes. No, there's teacher training. Yeah. Yeah. Clearly. Clearly. Good, I'm glad. What? The song? Okay. All right, now, let's get into our first example. You have the pages here in front of you, photographed from Vilna. The first sugya that we're going to deal with goes from the beginning of the perek, which is Elu Mitziot, about a third of the way down the page, to the bottom of the page, the last word being teko before the two dots. Everybody see that? Mark in your text, please, the beginning, where the beginning of the Mishnah, and then the end part where it says teko at the bottom. That's where the sugya begins and ends. Now, I don't know whether you've learned the sugya before or you haven't learned it before. If you've learned it before, do everything you can to forget everything you've learned so that we can do it this way and you'll understand how to think. What I want you to do now is to scan this sugya. Do not try to understand it. Do not try to understand. Just scan the sugya and mark with a pencil or pen or wherever is convenient for you the names of the Amoraim who appear in the sugya from the top to the bottom. To do that, it should not take you more than 2 minutes. Just scan. Are there any more here? That's right. Take mine. Okay? Did you scan it? To the bottom of the page where it says Teku, before the two dots. The very last line on that page. On the first page. Ah, there we go. That'll help. There we go. Yeah. It is important to be on the right page. Okay. Who would like to tell us, what are the names of the Amoraim who appear in this sugya? Which I hope you have as yet to understand. Yes. Who are the names? What are the names? Correct. Ukva Bar Chama, right? Rabbi Yirmiyah. Very good. Those are the three Amoraim that appear in the text. Now, before we go to understand what they're saying, the first thing we have to do is we have to, now we've scanned, now we have to identify, and then we have to map them. Yes. That's in the Mishnah, right? And if they're in the, but you're correct to notice that. If that's in the Mishnah, then they are whom? Tanaim, right? Then in the Gemara, they're Amoraim. Okay. Now, I'll just give you right now, I'll give you the data, who is who. Rabbi Yitzchak is a third generation Amora from Israel. Third generation Israeli Amora. That means he lived about 300, 280 to 320 in that range. Rabbi Ukva Bar Chama is the third generation Babylonian Amora. The same time as Rabbi Yitzchak, only in Babylonia as opposed to Israel. Rabbi Yirmiya is a fourth generation Israeli Amora. Fourth generation Israeli Amora. Now, based on that data that I've given you, you tell me what kind of sugi it is. It's an what? No, ask your question. Good question. Especially since the mix is in the third generation, right? Right. So then, let me ask you two more questions and then you'll already see the structure. Who do you think Rabbi Yirmiya is relating to? Why? Correct. That's right. So if we were to outline the sugya, we have the Mishnah. On that, we have a comment from a third generation Israeli Amora, a comment from a third generation Babylonian Amora, and then a comment of a fourth generation Israeli Amora. Why is the Babylonian Amora sticking in the middle? What? It could be because it's chronological. It could, or something different to say. It could be that he was entered in later, even by the stoma, and the original sugi is Israeli, right? That also could be. Meaning whom? How would he have access to Rav Ukva? But they were 1,000 miles apart. Travel. So now you're asking a question. You're saying, did Rabbi Yirmiya in the fourth generation already have available to him the statements of Ukva Bar Chama? Have those statements been brought from Babylonia to Israel? That is a very important question that we do not have any way of determining. That is why, by the way, there is a machloket rishonim, whether Ukva Bar Chama is relating to Rabbi Yitzchak or relating directly to the Mishnah. Did he know Rabbi Yitzchak? Or did he not know Rabbi Yitzchak? The Machloket Rishonim is based on their methodologies and the understanding of the sugya, not on the content. Based on the understanding of the form of the sugya. Yeah.
Let me ask the question back to the lecture.
They both quote each other. I'll give you just a little bit of data. In Rabbi Yochanan, who was in Israel, he never was in Bavel, he is quoted more than 2,000 times in the Babylonian Talmud. Of those 2,000 times, only 1/3 are presented in the Israeli Talmud. That means there's Israeli material in the Babylonian Talmud that's not in the Israeli Talmud. There's also Babylonian material that's in the Israeli Talmud that's not in the Babylonian Talmud. Theoretically, that's true, but I've been through the 10,000 sugyot in Shas. I haven't found one yet like that. So I feel very comfortable telling you that taxonomy. See, what I did was I took 30 yeshiva rabbeim that I trained. We went through all of Shas, broke it all up into individual sugyot, started to characterize them so we could come up with that taxonomy. And it's what they call in Hebrew baduk. There are no exceptions to what I've told you. Not that we've had discovered yet. God willing, now that we've conquered Iraq, we'll do archaeology, come up with another 1,000 pages of Talmud in Bezrat Hashem. Who knows what will be. But for right now, all right, now let's go a step further. Now we've established, see, you don't know any content in the sugya yet, right? No content. But you know already where the sugya started, where the sugya ended, who's relating to whom. Now, what kind of reflective strategization does that allow you? Now, let's say you're a student in fifth grade, sixth grade, seventh grade, because Amoraim are Mishnah, so they're learned already from the time a child is 10. Just Talmud is not. So what would you learn first? If I ask you, what do you learn? Now you know he's third, he's third, he's fifth. What do you, and then the Talmud on top of it. What do you learn first? You learn chronologically. First you read Rabbi Yitzchak, he's commenting on the Mishnah. Then Ukva Bar Chama, and there are two possibilities. Either he's commenting on Rabbi Yitzchak, which is less likely, or he's commenting on the Mishnah as a parallel Babylonian remark. And then you have Rabbi Yirmiyah commenting on Rabbi Yitzchak. Yes, I is. There are several stages. First, we call this mapping, identifying. Then learning it means learning the content of the Amoraim. Then learning the content of the Stamma de Talmuda. And then after that would come Rishonim. I certainly is. That's the idea. That's exactly the idea. And we want children to take ownership over the text by these skills so that they feel motivated to go on learning. That's exactly right. No, yes? Great question. Kol hakavod. The answer is that there were a group of scholars called the Nachotae, which means the Yordim, and they went from Eretz Yisrael to Bavel, and from Bavel to Eretz Yisrael, bringing the Torah of each place to the other place. They were very interesting personalities. It's interesting to study about for that purpose. Yeah. That's right. All oral. They would arrive after a 1,000-mile journey through the Fertile Crescent, land in Pumbedita, wash their hands and feet, take a bite of eat, stand up and begin to recite. And sometimes they would start to recite, and an Amora would be sitting there saying, do you mean Rabbi Yochanan said Asur? Maybe Rabbi Yochanan said Mutter? And the Nechota would say, just a minute. You would think, you know, I'm not sure now. So there would be two different versions of what Rabbi Yochanan said. That's how it grew. That's how it happened. These were shluchim. Yeah, they were shluchim. No, nothing was written. Devarim shebal peh iyata rashai lekotvan, as you mentioned. All right, now, the next thing on this sugya, our time is racing. On this sugya, I want to do one more exercise with you. Look at the Maimer of Rabbi Yirmiyah. And scan from there to the end of the sugya. Just Rabbi Yirmiyah, and tell me what are the words of Rabbi Yirmiyah and what are the words of the Talmud that have been inserted into Rabbi Yirmiyah. How are you looking? What are you looking for? Hebrew versus Aramaic. So look at the Hebrew phrases versus the Aramaic phrases. And you're going to see something amazing. You got it? Who would like to volunteer? Again, we're not yet at the point of comprehension. We're just mapping according to technical principles. What are the words of Rabbi Yirmiyah? Please. Keep going. Right, you missed one. A little further up. Kav shum shemin ba'arba mot mahu. See, he asked four questions. He asked, by Rabbi Yirmiyah. Rabbi Yirmiyah asked, because the Mishnah says that if a person found scattered fruit, then it will be his. So the question is, what does scattered mean? How much quantity in how much area? You have to define it legally. So he says, chatzi kav b'shtei amot mahu. Kabayim b'shmuna amot mahu. Kav shum shemin b'arba amot mahu. Kav tmare be, etc. He's asking questions like that, and in between the questions, Aramaic interpretation of that part of his question has been inserted. How do I know that Aramaic insertion is not Rabbi Yirmiyah? It's Aramaic. Not only is it Aramaic, it's Babylonian Aramaic, which is not likely that an Israeli Amora would be speaking. It's not only translation, it's also commentary. Because it gives here the svarot. It gives the logic behind that part of the question, according to the Talmud. But if you look up here on the board, you can see it a little better, because I've separated it out by red and by black, and I've slightly indented the stoma addition onto the sugya. You see on the right-hand margin, you have the questions of Rabbi Yirmiyah, and indented in, you have the Talmudic explanations of Rabbi Yirmiyah. Now, let me ask you this question. What difference does it make? For a student, what difference does it make whether he knows that that's part of Rabbi Yirmiyah or not part of Rabbi Yirmiyah? It helps to parse it, number one. Just to know pshat, who said what. Good. What else? Simplifies it. It helps you strategize stages, right? What else? Yeah. That's right. Now there's one other benefit, which is for more advanced students, and that is that when the Talmud interprets the statement of the Amora, that is the Talmud suggesting what it thinks is the interpretation of the Amora. It doesn't mean that's what the Amora originally intended. Sometimes that's called okimta in Gemara language. Okimta means ha'amada, setting up the interpretation in a certain direction because of the need of the sugya to do a certain hakira. But there are many cases in Shas where the interpretation by the Talmud of the Memra is for a later thought process, but it's not the pshat of what the Amora meant. And there, if you don't separate, you're completely lost. I'll give you an example. There's a machloket between Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish in the 8th parak of Yoma, whether or not, since you have to eat on Yom Kippur to be chayiv, you have to eat an amount that's called kachotzevet agasa, the amount of a large date. So Rabbi Zermach, look at Rabbi Yochanan Reish Lakish, if a person ate a chatzi shi'ur, are they chayiv deoraita or not chayiv deoraita? Rabbi Yochanan says, asur minatorah. Reish Lakish says, mutar minatorah. But the Talmud then gives you a svara that the reason why Rabbi Yochanan says asur min haTorah is because since you could eat another half and it would join together, that make it a dioraita isur, therefore the half itself is already asur dioraita. Now that's a svara. That's not part of the psak halacha of Rabbi Yochanan. What would happen if in another place in Shas I would find Rabbi Yochanan saying something that he doesn't hold that things joining together operate in that way? Then would I have a stira in Rabbi Yochanan, or would I not? I'd have a question on why the stoma interprets it that way there when it doesn't appear that way in another place. You see, there are very serious implications to mixing up the Memra and the Talmud on the Memra. Nevertheless, if you ask all of your frum friends who have learned in yeshivas if they know the difference in the Gemara between the Memra and the Gemara itself, the vast majority will tell you they never heard of such a distinction, and they don't know what you're talking about. And that's because methodology is not being taught in the schools. Only page after page after page should be tested on, and students go through years. One Rosh Yeshiva said to me in Israel, the reason why students today are not successful learning Talmud is they don't have enough Yirat Shamayim. So I said to him, let me understand what you're saying. The student is sitting in your yeshiva for 6 years, 15 hours a week, he's learning pages of Talmud he does not understand from teachers who are not teaching him method. At the end of the 6 years, he still wants to be frum. That's not Yirat Shamayim? That's plenty of Yirat Shamayim. The problem is not the student's Yirat Shamayim, it's your teacher's methodology. And I say this out of pain, because I view myself as a member of the yeshiva world. And I love the yeshivas. And the yeshivas are the source of where Torah will come. Torah will not come from academic institutions. Torah will come only from yeshivas. But the yeshivas have to teach right. If the yeshivas take our children and take from us thousands and thousands of dollars a year for education, and at the end of 6 years our kids can't learn their way through a paper bag, then something's rotten in Denmark and it has to be fixed. It has to be fixed. And to stick our heads in the sand and say, this is the way my Rebbe taught me, that's no terutz. So what if your Rebbe taught you? You survived. A Rebbe who learned how to learn despite the fact that he didn't learn methodology. He's a survivor. But what happened to all those that fell along the way? That means that my children also have to fall along the way because you don't want to teach the method? What kind of chutzpah is that? Teach my kids to learn. And a parent has the right to demand of schools that schools teach not only data, that schools teach skills and make children independent learners. There is no excuse for an average child not knowing how to learn Gemara by the end of grade 9. There is no excuse except inefficient education. And if they tell you it's difficult, that there's also, it's all nonsense. An average child should know how to learn an average page of Gemara by the end of grade 9, period. So, and as consumers, you need to bring the revolution. Because you have to stop accepting lokshin from people that are saying things that are simply not so. If you had a person install windows in your house, and then the rain came and flooded your living room, and you said the windows are not good, and he'd say, no, the rain was very strong, and there was wind, and your windows were probably were open an eighth of an inch, and you know, and not only that, your carpets were probably wet in the first place, you'd throw the guy out of the house. You'd say, get me another installer. What doesn't don't. So why, when teachers of your children tell you, well, Talmud is difficult, and your child, doesn't, he watches television at night, and doesn't have a Yerushalayim, why do you believe that? It has nothing to do with those things. It's because he's not learning methods. Okay. Yeah. Yes. Rabbi Yirmiyah, you're talking about? Rabbi Yirmiyah traveled to Eretz Yisrael very, very, very early in his learning career. He became a Talmid of Rabbi Zera. That means after Rabbi Zera was already there. Correct, correct.
Even though they're calling him Rabbi Yirmiyah as opposed to Rabbi Yirmiyah, but still, it's entirely possible. We have no way of knowing that he didn't speak this.
Highly unlikely, because it's possible. It is possible. It's possible, but it's highly unlikely. All right, do we have time for the second? I think we have time for the second one. Take the second, turn to the beginning of Perek HaMafkid. What page is that? The third page? On the third and fourth page, the sugya begins with the Mishnah, and go to the, and then mark that beginning, and then on the second, on the next page, you'll find the end of the sugya at the two dots where it says the word Ba'agam, about 10 to 15 lines down. Where there are two dots. Mark those two dots. Now go back to the beginning of the sugya and pre-scan it and tell me who are the Amoraim who appear in the sugya. Don't try to understand it. Try not to jump to conclusions. Look at the names of the people carefully and just mark them, because I didn't tell you who they are yet. Just mark them and then we'll discuss it. Okay? Okay, he wants to volunteer and tell us who are the Amoraim who appear in this sugya. Please. Correct? Yeah, but Rabbi Meir is a Tana. He's Rava and Rabbi Zera. Those are the three Amoraim who appear. Rami Bar Chama, and then Rava, and then Rabbi Zera. Now, Rami Bar Chama is a late, very late third generation Babylonian Amora. And he and the one, and Rava, the one following him, is a fourth generation Babylonian Amora. And Rabbi Zeira, this is the Rabbi's second Rabbi Zeira, who is a fifth generation Babylonian Amora, the student of Rava. So what kind of sugya is it? Amoraic sugya. That runs over three generations, right? By the way, Rami Bar Chama and Rava had the unusual distinction of being married to the same woman. Not at the same time, of course. Rami Bar Chama and Rava were both students of Rav Chista, and Rav Chista once brought his daughter and showed her these two great scholars, young scholars, and asked her which one she wanted as a husband, to which she said, I'll take both, thank you very much. And, that's right, and Rava jumped up and said, and I'm the latter one. Rami Bar Chama married her, died at an early age, and Rava then married her, and Rava appears in the Gemara many times as answering the kashas of Rami Bar Chama. There's more to that than intellectual exercise. But in any event, you have Rami Bar Chama asking a question, Rava answering the question, and then Rabbi Zeira commenting on Rava's answer. Now look what we know about the sugya, and we didn't learn any content yet. We know when it started, when it ended, what I'm supposed to learn first. You see how this can empower students in the study of Talmud? It's just so simple and so technical. Any child, and remember, Meimrot of Amoraim. Here, Rami Bar Chama and Rava and Rabbi Zeira is part of Mishnah. It's not Talmud, it's Mishnah, because remember that Mishnah includes the Mishnah of Rebbe, the Braitot, and the Meimrot. This is what a child should be learning until age 14, 15. He can scan sugyas of Amoraim, he can learn how they're structured, but the Talmud part that gives the Svarot and the analysis, that's for afterwards. So there's plenty to do in 5 years between 10 and 15. Sugyas, you mean? Yeah. The two dots are not really part of the text. They were added in by editors, by printers, and they cannot be relied upon. In this case, it worked. But in many cases, the two dots cannot be relied upon. And by the way, the division of sugyot, the way they're divided up in the Steinsaltz edition, is also unreliable. I don't know why. I don't know who did it for him. He didn't do it himself. He's a tremendous Talmid Chacham. But the students of his who did it did not parse the sugyot correctly. And you should not rely on it. Rely on it by tracking the Amoraim according to the chronological. When you see a chronological sequence ending and a new sequence beginning, that's the end of a sugya. Yeah. Yes. Okay, well, we've only been implementing this for 3 years. So it's hard. We don't have yet. We haven't had any scientific studies to determine fully scientific answers to what you're asking. But I can give you anecdotal evidence, because that we have lots for 3 years already. We have two goals. Our first goal is what you said, that a child should be given the skills to be able to learn independently in a way that's objectively accessible, what they call outcomes. The second thing that our second goal is that a child should feel an emotive connection with the Torah Shebaal Peh that is based on his feeling of confidence that he can function within it, and that therefore he feels he believes in it, he wants to observe it, he wants to learn it, he sees it as a value in his life. Those are our two. We put it in that order because we believe, from our experience, that children have a tendency to gravitate toward things they are capable of doing, and therefore, if a child learns that he is able to learn, he will love learning much more than if he is unable to learn. And our evidence, our anecdotal evidence from the schools we're working in is overwhelming. It's literally, I'll tell you just one story that I think says it all. We're working with a yeshiva in the north of Israel, which is populated about 35% by Ethiopian children, which who do not have a very large background in Torah Shebaal Peh, to say the least. At least not the Torah Shebaal Peh as we know it. And they were learning our program for Mishnah, which includes charts in the classroom of the Tanaim, web generation they're in. So I visited, I did a site visit, and the Rosh Hashiva said, let's call in some students to see how they're absorbing the material. So he called in a few students at random, and he asks one child, an Ethiopian child, he said to him, tell me, if you see a Mishnah that has Rabbi Yoshua and Rabbi Yehuda, how do you learn that Mishnah? So the boy smiled and said, Rosh Hashiva, first of all, it's not a machloket. Rosh Hashiva said, how do you know it's not a machloket? He said, Rosh Hashiva, Rabbi Yoshua is from Yavne and Rabbi Yehuda is from Usha, and a younger Tana is never cholek on an older Tana. The Rosh Hashiva said to him, and how do you know that Rabbi Yoshua is from Yavne and Rabbi Yehuda is from Usha? He said, because when I'm bored, I memorize the posters. Ask me any Tana, I'll tell you when he's from. So he did. He said, Rabbi Akiva. He said, Rosh Hashiva, that's easy. He's the second generation in Yavne. He's the Talmid of Rabbi Yoshua. He's the teacher of Rabbi Yehuda. So he said, Chanina Skana Kohanim. He said, well, he's from the time of the Beit HaMikdash, Beit Shammai, Beit Hillel. And with this went on for a number of minutes until the Rosh Hashiva turned to me and said, well, I guess they've absorbed the material. But what interested me was not so much that the child knew that data. What interested me was the look on his face when he was showing the Rosh Hashiva that he knew. He was speaking with confidence. This is not foreign material. I know who these Talmidei Chachamim are, and I know how to relate to them. That's what interested me, that he was so happy. He was happy with his learning. Yes?
Is there any anecdotal evidence from non-Yeshiva programs, secular students?
Yeah, I teach this. I taught this for years at Bar-Ilan to secular students. High school students. I teach Torah Shebal Peh 5 hours a week at an Israeli secular high school named Tichon Galili in Kfar Sava. And I taught them how to learn Mishnah, Be'al Peh, and I taught them about the Chachamim. I don't have to tell you what the environment was when I first went into the classroom, how the students were dressed and how they behaved. And I went in singing the Mishnah. They laughed, and I laughed, and what? Oh, okay, maybe another time. And by the end of the year, they not only learned a Perek of Mishnah Be'al Peh, Perek Arvei Pesachim, but then they asked me if I would come in the evenings to their homes and teach them Haggadah so they could do a Pesach the right way. And it didn't come from anything fancy. It just came from showing them that it's not a foreign literature, that they can get into it, they can learn it, they can enjoy it. And I believe, and you can, now that it's being recorded, you can say that, you can mark it with the date. I believe that 15 to 20 years from now, the system that I've described to you in the last 2.5 hours will become the standard system for teaching Torah Shebal Peh in schools and yeshivot around the world, and that we will have diagnostic instruments to be able to measure exactly where every learner is at any given time along his process toward independence, and that this will bring to a revival in the study of Torah Shebal Peh, the likes of which has never been seen in Jewish history. Be'ezrat Hashem, ken yi ratzon.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'll just say, this year was implemented in 4 and 5. It's a wonderful program, and that's why I insisted Rabbi Heyman change his appointment in Detroit to stay here to bring it to people, because I think it's very important. We, as our consumers who are, as he said, who are paying all this money, et cetera, we have to empower our schools to do this. It's a wonderful program. I hope you found it enjoyable. He's very accessible, Rabbi Heyman. By email, he'll be back in November. I don't know the exact date, but maybe we'll arrange a follow-up program. If people are interested, let me know. And thank you very much. If I can just make a quick announcement, you see our brochures. Just one thing to point out, if people are interested, Ilana Sober's class is starting on Wednesday night in our brochure. I'll tell you a little secret. It only says it's starting on the 14th. They're 4 independent classes because it's going to arrive at people's homes the following week, if you see that. So if anybody's interested, Wednesday night at Ur Chaim, Ilana Sober is giving a 4-part series, 4 independent classes
on the Haftarot of Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, except we've got all our programs. They're actually not all. We have most of our programs here listed. I hope we'll see you. And thank you very much. And
I just want to apologize that I can't stay to answer many questions because I really have to give a seminar in Detroit in 6 hours. But I just and you can, any questions you have, please feel comfortable to write to me by email
through that site,
or you can get my personal email from Rabbi Kelman, and I answer everyone who writes to me. So please feel at home. I just unfortunately cannot stay now.
Thank you very much. Okay.